KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The default assumption is parenthood, especially for women. You know, the expectation is that you not only want kids, you like crave kids.
Republicans have a majority in the state Senate, and there's a number of bills that they want to have discussed, and maybe they'll only get to the floor. Maybe they get out of the Senate and don't make it to the House.
People think that, oh, malaria kills, other diseases are killing people from a low socioeconomic status. But cancer is the same.
Dr. Jackson Orr, I'm talking about cancer. People are raising awareness about cancer today. It's World Cancer Day, and we're going to talk about some of the myths and facts around cancer around the world. Also, why have kids? We're going to ask you that question. That's coming up at 9:40 today. Jerry Kornfield is a reporter and columnist covering state and local politics for the Everett Herald. You heard him talking about the legislature. We are in week four of the state legislative session in Olympia. A number of bills coming before them, a number of issues being raised. Among them, a parent notification bill regarding abortion, people who are underage. The Republicans are taking that up first. I asked Jerry Kornfield why they're taking that up right out of the gate.
There are surveys that show it's a popular concept that a teenager not be allowed to go get an abortion without their parent or guardian knowing about it. So, you know, on some level, it has a general public sentiment behind it. The larger question is, it is a restriction on the rights of abortion, and Washington probably has led the nation as being supportive of abortion rights.
It's just interesting they decided, taking over the Senate the way they have, to make this one of their flag-waving issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's in some ways it may be a bookend to the Democrats are pushing, once again, the Reproductive Parity Act, which would require health plans that cover some maternity care to also provide coverage for abortion. So it's some ways it's a response to that. But in other ways, it's just it recognizes that Republicans have a majority in the state Senate, and there's a number of bills that they want to have discussed. And maybe they'll only get to the floor. Maybe they get out of the Senate and don't make it to the House. But they really do want to have some discussions on some of these issues. Some are social. Today, they're expected, once again, to consider some reforms to the workers' compensation system that have been just, you know, languishing in their drawers, and now they've pulled them out, and they hope to pass them.
What do they mean by reforms to workers' comp? What are they looking at?
Well, last year there was a number of changes. One of them, for example, is to end the workers, they get injured, and they can be kept on and receive compensation payments for life. And they started a process by saying, hey, let's give you a deal where you'll get a lump sum payout, and we'll be done with it. And they called it structured settlements, where anyone over the age of 55 could negotiate with the state and an insurer on an amount of money. And once they got that amount of money, the state would be done having to pay them anything. Now they want to remove the age limit and say any worker who's injured, rather than have the state compensate them for a lifetime of disability, let's negotiate a deal and pay them once. And in the long term, that's supposed to save hundreds of millions of dollars. Actually, I think they're projecting over $2 billion over 25 years in last year's program. So they see it as a money-saving move, and that's one of the big pieces.
Democrats supporting that in any form?
No, not at this stage. I mean, this is one of those test votes, I think, in the state Senate, where we'll see how strong the coalition is. It's going to have at least 25 votes. There might be one or two Democrats. Senator Jim Hargrove is pretty moderate. Senator Steve Hobbs is pretty moderate. Senator Brian Hatfield has been moderate. And so one or more of them might cross over on the structured settlement bill. But in general, this is sort of a test of the two coalitions, if you will. 25-24 votes are expected on most of them.
By the way, in terms of tests of the coalition, what's happened with the GET hearings and the GET bill, the Guaranteed Education Tuition Program?
Well, last week, at the end of the week, there were some hearings in which the state actuary and the state treasurer came in and said, look, it's really not that bad if the universities don't raise tuition for the next couple of years, and if the universities do not create what's called differential tuition, meaning someone who enrolls and wants to be an engineering major, they'll be charged a little bit more than the person enrolls and says, I want to be a liberal arts major. It just costs more to teach an engineering student. So if they don't do those two things, the projection is it'll get back on track in a matter in a few years. You know, it's one of those things where on paper there's a hole, $631 million, but that hole goes away if the system doesn't change and the number of people who get in each year, they continue to get in, their money will be put in the bank and that'll pay off those who need it.
So, but is there any expectation that the legislature will be putting enough money into the higher education system to help those institutions avoid raising tuition for a couple of years?
Well, that's a good question because the budget fight, which won't really begin in earnest till March, and both sides say they want to do that. And both the Democrat side, Republican side, House and Senate, everyone says they wish to come up with, I think the magic number is around $225 million. That number is going to fluctuate. It's probably going to go down. I think there's a commitment to adding money for higher education. Whether it's enough for 2 years of no tuition increases, my guess would be they'll put enough in so tuition doesn't go up for 1 year. They'll come back in January 2014 and try again and do it sort of year to year, at least until the economy is growing at a rate where everyone can say, okay, we're out of the recession, and now we can do some long-term investment.
Jerry Kornfield is talking to us. He's a reporter and columnist covering the state and local politics for the Everett Herald. So speaking of the coalition in the Senate, Rodney Thom was the one pushing that and promoting the idea of ending GET. Was this a setback for him in any way?
No, I don't think it's a setback. He'll still push to see some changes. But what he has is a chairwoman of the Senate Higher Education Committee, Senator Barbara Bailey of Oak Harbor, who has held some hearings and had some reports and come to the conclusion that, you know, we may be able to keep the program running as it is as long as we can help the higher ed institutions avoid tuition increases. So she's open to not making any major changes. I mean, getting rid of the program would be pretty dire and pretty drastic. Closing the door temporarily to new enrollees, you know, that's always kind of there as a possibility, but ultimately, as you mentioned before, they need to come up with some money for higher education, and that's going to be a budget battle. I would project that the four-year schools, WSU and University of Washington, are probably not going to get as much money as they would hope, where the other schools that don't have the big programs and the big researchers, they'll probably get enough money to not have to raise tuition.
What about the other education reform measures that have been discussed, from figuring out ways to tighten education budgets to require a student improvement grade for schools? Where are those going at this point?
Well, again, it's one of those issues that the Republicans and the Senate majority coalition want to push as far as they can. And I think they're going to get out of the committee, the Senate Education Committee. Its chairman is Steve Litzau. He's a sponsor of many of the bills. It may get onto the floor, but I don't think it passes in the House. But interestingly, tomorrow, on Tuesday, the House Education Committee is going to hear several bills that are identical to the ones in the Senate. So they're going to at least listen to the bills. In the end, we'll see some reforms in education. I think you'll see a tighter evaluation system. Principals are going to get a little power, I think, to choose which teachers work in their schools. I think there's going to be a little more emphasis on test scores, so that students don't get advanced from third to fourth grade without a free pass, if you will. And I think the state's going to give itself some power to take over failing schools. Now, what that'll look like, it won't be immediate, but I think those are the three changes I would imagine will happen this session.
And Senator Randy Becker, she wants to see some changes to the child protective policies. This is in response to what happened with the Powell family. Tighter controls, tighter notification to police. Are those going to pass?
Yeah, it's a very emotional issue. I think there's another hearing in the House committee this week on the same bill. I think everyone wants to do something. The problem is what they want to do may run up against the rights of parents and the laws. And so it's going to be a fine line. I wouldn't make a prediction on whether they can make major changes on the visitation in this session. This is one of those sessions where, although it's the long session, eventually all the focus will be on funding, education, and writing a budget that's balanced. You have a governor who has been pretty sort of low profile to this point, and eventually he's going to have to get involved. This is probably one of those issues that may not be able to last through the whole session just because their focus will be pulled away from it.
Yeah, they still have to close that budget shortfall, don't they? Any discussion on whether they'll extend the B&O tax and the other tax, or is that still in the works?
It's still in the works. I mean, if today was the vote, I think you get a lot of Democrats in both chambers that vote to extend the tax. They don't see it as an increase, and they feel that the people who are paying a little bit extra for beer and those attorneys and accountants who are paying the service fees, they feel like, hey, you've made it this long, we can keep going farther with it, maybe even make them permanent. But they're taxes, and no one wants to vote on taxes if they don't have to. If the economy continues to grow at the pace it's going, they could do a couple of small twists in the budget. For example, suspend pay hikes for teachers under the Initiative 732. They've done it for a couple years running. If they do it again, that's about a third of the whole right there, just that money they don't have to spend. So a couple of moves like that, and the next thing they know, that shortfall is gone.
Some of the highlights to be watching for this week, week four of the Washington State Legislative Session. Jerry Kornfield is a reporter and columnist covering state and local politics for the Everett Herald. This is Weekday.
#916, the latest on cancer research and treatments in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Hi, this is Melissa Block with NPR News. Together, KUOW and NPR bring you stories you won't hear anywhere else. Stories that go beyond the headlines and keep you inspired and informed. Your financial support makes this all possible. If it's been a while since you've made a gift to KUOW, please renew your support today. It's easy. Go online to KUOW.org. Thanks.
Cloudy and 46 degrees in Seattle. Expect clouds all day with a high of 51. Then it's a chance of rain overnight and showers tomorrow. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:17. Deciding to have a child is a big decision, but so is deciding not to. We're going to take a look at the choice to not have kids in 20 minutes on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Today is World Cancer Day, but we're not sending cards. We are instead raising awareness. A day dedicated to dispelling the myths about cancer, its causes, how it's treated, and how it affects people around the world. Dr. Jackson Orem directs the Uganda Cancer Institute. He was once Uganda's only oncologist. 10,000 patient visits a year. Sir, that is a lot of work.
Yeah, but of course I think a lot is happening as well.
And Dr. Corey Casper is Medical Director of Infection Control at Seattle Cancer Alliance, assistant member at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Good to see you.
Thank you for having us.
So let's just some background here on, and before we go to your stories. Why are we talking about cancer as that there are myths about cancer? Why? What myths do people have about cancer? Cancer is just a health issue? Why is that a myth?
Well, I think that the greatest myth that is probably good to talk about today is the fact, the myth that cancer is only a disease that affects people who are wealthy enough to succumb to it. I think that World Cancer Day is, I think, a way for us to think about the fact that cancer kills more people in low and middle resource countries than HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria combined.
Well, what do they mean by cancer's wide-reaching social, economic, development, and human rights implications? I can see that. That's what they mean by it's not just a health issue?
Correct.
Political issue?
I mean, I think that Dr. Orem can speak to the effect that cancer has on a society and on the family. It takes an enormous toll, just as it does here. But I think in resource-limited settings, a diagnosis of cancer is an enormous issue for a family and also for a society. And there really aren't strategies to deal with that just yet, but I think that they're starting to emerge.
Well, what do they mean when they say cancer is a global epidemic, affects not just wealthy, affects elderly, developing countries, but a disproportionate burden on developing countries?
Absolutely. But the biggest problem is that for a long time, people had thought that cancer was a problem of only the rich north.
Why?
Well, because I think that is how they have known. First of all, there are no specific ways of enumerating cancers in the developing countries. So not very many people know the exact burden, and yet it is really an underlying problem that has been sitting beneath the common known problems in the developing countries, especially the infectious diseases. I think that is probably the biggest problem.
That it sits underneath all these other diseases.
Absolutely.
We focus on these other diseases.
Absolutely.
What was the number? It's higher than HIV and...
So I think when most people think about global health issues, and here in Seattle we're clearly an epicenter for global health, I think people think of the big diseases that are infectious.
Malaria, HIV.
Tuberculosis. But actually, if you look at the figures, those three diseases combined kill less people than cancer does in lower and middle income countries.
Now, is that because when we speak of cancer, we're speaking of a huge umbrella under which many different problems arise?
I think that's
right. Different parts of the body is...
Right. So not all cancers are the same. So lung cancer isn't the same as, let's say, bladder cancer. But yet, I still think that people don't recognize the contribution that cancer makes to mortality and to the health systems in countries where infectious diseases are a huge problem. I'm not here to say that HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria aren't large problems. But I think that they are relatively well recognized. So there are a number of people who speak to those issues, but there are very few people who speak to the issues of cancer.
All right. So, for example, survival rate for patients who make it to the Uganda Cancer Institute is fairly low. This is from a Joanne Silberner article that was on the radio earlier from PRI. We get 22,000 new cases annually, you said in the story. Of those, 20,000 die within a year. Now, how different is that from the developed world, just to start?
Well, the difference is that the majority of people diagnosed with cancer are dying in the developing countries. And in the developed countries, on the contrary, at least the chances of survival or living with cancer is much higher. So that means that people who are living with cancer and probably also people who are getting cured of cancer is much higher in the developed countries than in the developing countries. In other words, there are so many people who are dying unnecessarily of cancer in the developing countries.
Dying unnecessarily because treatment has become so much more effective in those places where there are resources?
Absolutely. Treatment is much more effective. People are coming earlier. That means diagnosis is being made at a stage where the disease is manageable, contrary to what is happening in the developing countries.
I think that's an important point. I think the overwhelming majority of patients who present for cancer care in low-resource settings present at a very late stage of disease, as we would say an advanced stage of cancer. And even if they were to present here in Seattle for treatment, it would be very challenging to treat them. So even just raising the awareness of cancer, letting people know that something, a mass or something that's not feeling well, could be sort of, if that were brought to attention earlier, would have a much greater chance of success.
But this is a cost issue, is it not?
It's not just a cost issue, but it is a cost issue. So cancer care can be expensive. But I think even if you look at this in an economic model, for instance, the most common cancer in children in Uganda is a cancer called Burkitt lymphoma. Here in Seattle, if a child develops Burkitt lymphoma, they have about a 95% chance of survival. In Uganda, that number is much lower, maybe as low as 30%. And the full course of treatment for Burkitt's lymphoma in a place like Uganda may be about $800. Now, that's a lot of money, but it's not as much. A case of multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis may be as much as $2,000. But I don't think that we sit there and say that that's too expensive to treat. So I don't think it's just a cost issue. I think it's also a conception. I think people haven't conceptualized cancer as a disease that can be treated and can be treated effectively and efficiently in low-resource settings. And that's something that's, I'd say, a key myth that we'd like to sort of try and turn on its head.
By the way, that starts as an infectious disease.
Right. And so one of the focuses of the Hutchinson Center's program in Uganda and the collaboration with the Uganda Cancer Institute is a focus on infections which cause cancer. So across the world, probably about 20 to 25% of cancers are caused by an infection. But that number in Uganda is much, much higher. So almost 60% of cancers in Uganda are caused by an infection.
Why would that be?
That's a great question, and that's actually what the basis is of our research. Dr. Orem has been studying this for many years, and I think that there are a number of reasons. Jackson, I don't know if you have.
What are some reasons?
Well, I think given the fact that the concentration of efforts in the developing countries is on infection, that means actually the baseline infection rate can cause anything, including cancer. So the chronic complication of cancer infection, I mean of infection eventually is development of cancers. So if you are addressing infectious diseases and you are not paying attention to cancer, that means you are playing double standards actually.
Double standards?
Absolutely. Because you are not addressing one of the consequences of the high burden of infection. That is assuming actually that what Dr. Corey is saying is true.
I think what Jackson may be sort of also referring to is that cancer is the risk of cancer is increased in some cases up to 3,000-fold in people with HIV. In a country like Uganda, there are hundreds of millions of dollars spent annually treating HIV disease, but relatively no funds are spent on dealing with cancer. So you have patients who are surviving their HIV disease, but then subsequently succumbing to cancer. And so I think what that is that's a focus on infectious diseases with a lack of focus on cancer, leading to, at the end, outcomes and deaths that are avoidable.
Well, help me understand that a little more, because wouldn't the focus on HIV lead to diagnosing of these other infections?
The experience that I've had in Uganda and places like it is that there are such limited resources, even though there are enormous resources devoted to HIV, they're simply not enough. So in Uganda right now, about 45% of people who need antiretroviral therapy, HIV medicines, actually receive it. So what that means is that if people can't even be treated for the HIV disease, then there are no additional resources to deal with the complications of the HIV disease. And that's why I think cancer has been under-recognized and under-treated in that setting.
Maybe I can clarify that a little bit. Of course, with a lot of emphasis on HIV and the programs, there has been nothing that focuses on cancer. And that is ironic because in the first place, one of the things, the indicator that there was a new disease called HIV was the development of unusual cancers. And the fact that at the end of the day, up to now, there is no specifically dedicated program addressing HIV-related cancer is really something which is unbelievable. And of course, now that is being added to by the number of people who are living longer because of proper treatment of HIV and succumbing to cancer as a result of their HIV without any program that addresses their issues.
What cancers are they succumbing to?
There are now a group of cancer we call the non-HIV-related cancers. That is now a big thing because patients with HIV are now developing cancers that are commonly found in the population, including things like lung cancer, colon cancer, breast cancer, etc., secondary to the longevity of their life as a result of proper treatment. But that is in addition to the traditionally non-HIV-related malignancies, like, for instance, Kaposi sarcoma, lymphomas, and even cervical cancer. Those are still there in our part of the world, but there's nothing that addresses the issues.
We're talking about cancer today because February 4th is World Cancer Day or World Cancer Awareness Day. Cancer's leading cause of death worldwide, 7.6 million deaths in 2008, lung, stomach, liver, colon, breast cancers cause the most cancer deaths each year. The most frequent types of cancer differ between men and women as well. And cancer-causing viral infections, like we were just talking about, responsible for up to 20% of cancer deaths in low- and middle-income countries, and 70% of all cancer deaths in 2008 occurred in low- and middle-income countries. So this is about awareness. This is about early diagnosis.
I think it's also Stephen.
Let me just also say that that's Dr. Corey Casper, is medical director of infection control at Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, and Dr. Jackson Orem directs the Uganda Cancer Institute. So, Dr. Casper.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I guess I think that when you talk about a topic like this, it can be very heavy, and I think that you can sort of feel as if there's very little you can do. I think what compels me are some of the stories that I see in Uganda and some of the stories I see here in Seattle. And the way that I think about it is that focusing on these infection-related cancers offers an enormous opportunity. So I think that if you right now, we have vaccines against several infections which cause cancer. So hepatitis B virus, we have a vaccine against that, which is given universally now at birth. When that was implemented in Taiwan, liver cancer in kids, which was the most common cancer, was eradicated. So essentially, the eradication of a cancer with a vaccine. That's an amazing concept. At the Hutchinson Center, some of the science that we've done there contributed to a vaccine against human papillomavirus. That's the cause of cervical cancer. And it's now estimated that we can eliminate 90% of cervical cancer cases worldwide with a vaccine. So I think that the promise in the work that we do and what sort of makes it not quite as grim is that there's the potential that we could eliminate 20% of cancers across the world by continuing to focus on those infections and developing prevention strategies. Could be vaccines, could be medications.
Lung, stomach, colon, breast. Those are at this point, well, I guess that's not true about breast cancer. They're not necessarily started by viruses, are they, or by infections?
So that list that you read is a list of the most common cancers, certainly here in the United States. I think when you look across the world, some of the cancers, for instance, in sub-Saharan Africa, cervical cancer is among the most common cancers in women. Liver cancer in West Africa is the most common cancer in the population. So that number varies by where you are. Here in Seattle, maybe about 10% of cancers are caused by an infectious disease, and that's still not a small number. And when I think of, in my mind, I think of the four broad causes of cancer. So you can have an infection which causes your cancer. You could have something in the environment, and I define that broadly. Maybe if you're unfortunate to be next to Chernobyl when it goes off, you have an increased risk of thyroid cancer. There is your genetic factors. If every member of your family has had breast cancer, there's a good chance you will as well. And then there's the unknown. But in those four causes of cancer, the one that we can do something about right now is infectious causes of cancer. So I think that many people ask us, why do we have this partnership between Seattle and Uganda? And we think that this combination of the expertise we have at the Hutchinson Center and the burden of disease and the expertise that's at the Uganda Cancer Institute, together I think we can focus on these infections which cause 20% of cancers and come up with preventions or better treatments. And that's really exciting.
So one of the myths that this World Cancer Day talks about is cancer is my fate, that you get cancer and it's a death sentence. But even across the world, the right strategies can reduce cancer by fatalities by a third. Is that right?
Yeah, that is true. I think a third of cancers can actually be prevented.
Prevented.
A third can be treated, and then a further third can actually be given a long, a good life or a good quality of life after giving them at least some pain control and then other issues that can make them feel better.
For those people who haven't had it prevented and come to your clinics, do you have the resources to give them the controls they need?
Of course, that is where the issues are. If we don't have a good supporting system, a good at least support from government and then also donor or funding agencies, you cannot do much. That is where the problem is.
What, when you talk about it, when you talk about the cancer, HIV, malaria, TB, one could get the impression that these would be competing needs competing for a limited dollar. So how are you working jointly with, from the Gates Foundation all the way to the Fred Hutch in order for it to be a more seamless approach, if that's possible?
I think the most important thing is actually, first of all, to kind of come to a consensus of knowing that these are all issues. And despite the fact that at the moment the priority list is skewed, we can actually strike a balance somewhere, given the fact that these conditions, all of them have at least something in common. So I think that is what is really needed, a proper strategy of handling all these as health issues.
Where does that happen? Does that happen in the government in Uganda? Does it happen when you go to donor meetings? Where does that happen?
I think it should be all over. And actually, that is where there is need for at least the voice of agencies like the World Health to come in to advise governments what to do. And then also the donor community to understand what the issues are and how we should, I would say, re-engineer the landscape
of healthcare and include not only cancer but other non-communicable diseases into the agenda. And I think that has also happened already. Last year in September, there was this high-profile meeting that took place in New York. I think that is a good start, and it has to be followed by at least proper strategy of handling non-communicable diseases, among which cancer is actually one of the biggest.
Well, what does that look like? You are no longer, I understand, the only oncologist in Uganda. Is that right? Yeah. You were once the only oncologist. Now how many are there?
Well, I think...
Are there enough?
Within the collaboration that we have with the Fred Asison Cancer Research Center. And I must say that this has been one of the first or the earlier interventions that we have done in our own... given our own understanding of what the issue is. And I must give credit to my colleague, Dr. Corey Casper, who, together with me, started raising this alarm, and many more people are now joining us in trying to tackle this issue. And we realized that you need to start with three things. You need to start with, of course, research is very important. You need to also look at the care issues that you need to address. And then thirdly, human resource in terms of capacity building for the carers, for the patients. And in that regard, I think we have done very well. We have trained now, as you're asking for figures, close to six senior level doctors have been trained at the Fred Asison Cancer Research Center. They have returned. And that is the reason why you see me comfortable in the studio right now, because I know that, you know, there are other people who are handling issues instead of me, even when I take time off.
How further along is Uganda compared to the rest of the under-resourced world in Africa and around the world? Where does Uganda stand?
Uganda is a very fortunate country because the fight against cancer in Uganda started, I would say, in the 50s. Because really? In 1958, a groundbreaking a discovery was made in Uganda of a cancer that affects children called Burkitt's lymphoma. And that was followed by intense research in this cancer because it was characterized by fast growth and then also very sensitive response to chemotherapy. And that made the United States National Cancer Institute to take interest in Uganda and set up a center in 1967 at the Uganda Cancer Institute to study cancer related to this disease, and in particular because this type of cancer was known to be caused by an infection called Epstein-Barr virus. That was also discovered around 1964.
Isn't that interesting that Epstein-Barr is responsible for that cancer?
Exactly.
Responsible for many things.
Exactly.
And it's important, I think, to note that that was discovered from tissue that was taken at the Uganda, at the site of the Uganda Cancer Institute, and the first place anywhere in the world where combination chemotherapy was given to treat cancer, which now are standard here in the United States and around the world, was first done at the Uganda Cancer Institute. So I think when people think about what's possible in sort of a setting where resources are limited and where the burden of cancer is high, I think it's important to think about the successes. And I think that the fact that we identified a new type of lymphoma in Uganda, that I think that the fact that the virus that 90% of us around the world have, Epstein-Barr virus, was first identified in Uganda, these are all really important things to keep in your mind when you think about the possibilities of working collaboratively between the United States and places like Uganda.
Well, raising alarm was the phrase you used. Raising alarm? I mean, Fred Hutchison is here. It's an important institution. It's in the same city as where lots of healthcare dollars are being spent. Why is alarm necessary?
So I think this goes back to the question you were asking before, which is, you know, what can be done about this and what's the format? And I agree with Jackson that I think that certainly, you know, these international forums and at high-level governmental meetings, these are important. But I also think it's important to remember why we got sort of – you can argue as to where we are with cancer in the United States. But I think the fact that we put so much emphasis on trying to treat and research cancer now really did not so much come from the higher level, but it came from the ground level. So it was really when the First Lady of the United States came out with the announcement that she had breast cancer that the National Cancer Act in 1971 was signed, and that really sort of set cancer research and care in this country as a high priority. So it really came from the public, not so much from the top, but rather from the bottom.
Wasn't it because people thought that it was a death sentence and that there was nothing they could do about it?
Absolutely. And actually, the dean of the School of Public Health at the school in Uganda at Makerere University tells a very interesting story. He's from a smaller village outside the capital, and he tells us that there was a gentleman from his village who had lymphoma, a type of cancer, who somehow found his way to the Uganda Cancer Institute for treatment and did well with his treatment and went back to the village. And when people saw that this disease could be well treated and could be survived, they were amazed, and also they were very encouraged. And that small village is one of the highest referring villages of patients to the Uganda Cancer Institute now. And I think that that really shows the power of advocates, of patients, and of survivors. And I think that's a message. I think that there are a number of stories that we can tell. There's young children that we see every day. I mean, Jackson sees them every day at the Cancer Institute. I see when I visit. But these stories of these children who come from far away with very advanced disease but survive, that's an amazing message, and I think that's what needs to get out.
All right. Well, we get that message here in the developed world. We see Seattle Cancer Care Alliance ads. We see all these ads through the media and the developed world. What's the mechanism by which you are transmitting that same message to the under-resourced areas?
I think one of the things that has been happening in our country is that a number of high-profile people have been affected by cancer lately. And that in itself is actually showing that cancer is a respect of no person. And these high-profile people actually have been also lobbying for cancer, because they are saying now that, you know, if we can be affected, what about the other people? The good thing with some of them is that they have the means to get treated, if not within the country, but outside the country. But at the end of the day, you still belong to the community. So that means there is need for something. And I think our government has taken that seriously. And there is some indicators that actually cancer is slowly being taken seriously in our country.
So for World Cancer Day, you had these four myths you wanted to talk about. Cancer is not just a health issue. It's a disease of the wealthy. It's not just a disease of the wealthy or the elderly or developed countries. It's around the world. It's not a death sentence, and it's not your fate. There are support groups and efforts underway with the right strategies to prevent a third of the cancers that people get. Are there infectious disease links that are most intractable or surprising to you? I mean, we've talked about some that we know about. Are there some out there that are still to be discovered and uncovered?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that there's two parts of that question. One is that, you know, right now we only have vaccines or medications for a fraction of the infections which cause cancer. So one thing that I think is an enormous possibility is increasing that number. So for instance, right now, hepatitis C virus, a very common cause of liver cancer, we have no vaccine against that. And I think that if we were to develop a vaccine, we know that if you treat hepatitis C effectively, which you can now do, you reduce the risk of cancer. That's good, but if we could prevent that, that's an enormous opportunity. We talked about Epstein-Barr virus. It's a very common cause of lymphoma, some causes of stomach cancer. If we could develop a vaccine against that, it would be amazing in terms of what could be prevented. And that's work that currently the collaboration is looking at. But you bring up an interesting question as well. You mentioned lung cancer. You know, there are people who clearly know patients with lung cancer who never smoked, who get the disease at a young age. And the question is always, why? Why did I get this disease? You know, there is an infection which causes lung cancer in sheep. Viruses are very species specific. And so if there is a virus which causes lung cancer in sheep, you would think that there would be a virus which could cause lung cancer in adults, in humans. And so one of the projects that Dr. Aram and I are working on is to look at people who have a very compromised immune system. So for instance, HIV, or they've had a transplant and they're on medications to suppress their immune system. These patients have a very high increased risk of things like lung cancer, lip cancer, skin cancers. We don't completely understand why. But if we can examine tissue from those patients, we think we can find the potential to find new infectious causes of cancer. And if we can find those, the potential is to prevent them or to better treat them. So that's another thing that we're quite excited about.
Hmm. Anything you want to add to that, Dr. Oram?
Well, of course, the other issue is to treat cancer very well. One of the things that I believe in is that with proper treatment, you can push back cancer. You can push back cancer from a high stage to a low stage, or you can even actually eliminate it in an individual who is already affected. So we should look at it from the point of view of the community and then also from the point of view of the individual, because the individual wants to get cured, and there's a lot that can be done in that aspect, be it what we call therapeutic vaccine, be it targeted chemotherapy treatment, etc. The main aim is actually to eliminate the cancer cells from the individual. Yeah.
World Cancer Day, raising awareness about cancer, and we have links to much more that you can read about, including a series of stories that Joanne Silberner did back in December you might want to take a listen to. Dr. Jackson Orem directs the Uganda Cancer Institute. Dr. Corey Casper is Medical Director of Infection Control at Seattle Cancer Care Alliance and Assistant Member at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Appreciate you both talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's Weekday.
Some thoughts on making the decision to not have kids in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting violinist Itzhak Perlman in a single-night recital on February 19th at Benaroya Hall. Ticket information online at seattlesymphony.org.
Medicine by the numbers. Can the scrutiny of subtle patterns using massive data crunching see things that even advanced MRIs can't see?
You need mathematical algorithms which have high precision in order to be able to detect the kind of changes in the voice that occur during Parkinson's.
The mathematics of big data medicine, next time on The Takeaway from Public Radio International.
That's this afternoon at 1 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance's new Proton Therapy Center, a partnership with ProCure Treatment Centers. SCCA's new Proton Therapy Center allows doctors to precisely target cancerous tumors while minimizing effects on surrounding tissue. More at sccaprotontherapy.com.
46 degrees, mostly cloudy in Seattle. Forecast calls for clouds through the day with a high of 51. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:46. If you could take a character from the pages of a book, bring them to life and hang out with them, who would you choose and why? Librarian and book guru Nancy Pearl joins us for that conversation in about 35 minutes.
But before that, in Seattle, most people have cats, and then dogs, and then children. Deciding to have a child is a big deal. Deciding not to, equally a big deal. And we were wondering, why and when did you decide not to have children? What conversations did you have with your partner, your family, your friends, and what was the reaction? We want your story. 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. You can give us a call. You can also email us weekday@kuow.org. This question prompted by Sharon Pien Chan's editorial in the Seattle Times, Why I'm Not Having Kids. You wrote that column. I imagine you wrote that column and then you wondered, do I really want to write this column? Do I really want people to be?
Thanks for having me on, Steve.
Thank you.
Yeah, I probably spent about 4 weeks thinking and reporting and researching this column and debating whether I really wanted to do it. And I think I have a huge, deep admiration for parents, people that decide to have children.
You have some yourself. Parents.
Yes, I have parents, and I'm very grateful they did not make the decision that I did. Some of my best friends are parents. But my husband and I decided to do something different. I was tired of being asked, and I didn't want people, you know, it was like when I was single and people kept asking me, so when are you going to get married, young lady? That used to make me so mad. So this was becoming that question for me. I didn't want people to presume that my husband and I could not have children and to feel sorry for me. I've never been pregnant. My husband and I didn't not try to have children. But I didn't want people to presume that this was a conscious, intentional choice that we made that we're really happy about.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Yes.
Can you change your mind?
Yes, I'm a woman. I can always change my mind.
What about your husband?
he could change his mind too. I mean, I think all relationships are different. You can decide when you get married or when you're dating that you don't want to have children, and
I mean, the reason I'm asking, because you, of course, could make it so that you can't change your mind, or he couldn't change his mind. He could have an operation, you could have an operation.
Yes. In fact, there were readers who emailed me who said, you should get your tubes tied. Don't look back. And there were, I actually received an email from one woman who did have her tubes tied and had a lot of trouble finding a doctor who would do it for her because she was so young. I don't think I'm going to go there.
How come? Keeping your options open, or is this another reason?
No, I do want to reserve the right to change my mind. And, you know, it's an invasive procedure. I don't want to undergo an unnecessary invasive procedure. At some point, I'll be too old to have children.
We should get him in here because he could do it. Less invasive.
Right, exactly. Why is it always a woman who has to get tubes tied?
No, I agree with you on many levels. But that would be one way to sort of like finalize that decision.
Yes, or you continue to use birth control.
Yeah, yeah, yes. But that, of course, always, you hope it always works.
Yes.
You have different levels of assuredness.
There's nothing quite so stressful as standing over a pee stick and wondering if you're pregnant.
I
think
imagine.
Both ways, whether you want to have a child or you don't want to have a child.
All right, when did you decide?
How
far into your marriage did you decide?
Well, my husband and I have been together since 2000, but we've only been married probably for 4 years. And we started having these discussions pretty seriously around my last birthday in July, because I just realized at some point I was getting close to the age where it would become difficult, or we would have to go through extensive fertility treatments to have children. So we spent about 5 months talking about it, and we came to a decision in November.
And what were your basic arguments, reasons? For not having children?
I would say that had both of us imagined ourselves as parents our whole lives? You know, was this something, did I grow up wanting to have a baby? And I did not. And my husband said the same thing. We went on this vacation in November where I said at the beginning of the trip, we're going to think about what things would you regret on your deathbed not doing? And we shared our answers at dinner the final night. And at that dinner, neither of us mentioned children. And that was when we realized that we were not going to have children.
Why do you think it was that even as a young person, like a teenager, when first started being an issue, you knew you didn't want to have children?
Oh, I didn't know when I was a teenager I didn't want to have children. I assumed it was an option in my life. But I guess I don't really like people telling me what I should do and shouldn't do, so I never fully committed to it either.
Because people were saying you should have children?
Yeah.
What was your mom and dad's reaction? What were your parents' reactions?
My mom said, that was the most stressful thing. Deciding this and telling my parents was the most stressful thing. They already have a grandchild. My brother has a 1.5-year-old. But my mom's reaction was, don't do it if you don't want to. You won't like it. And she said, it's different for me. I always wanted to have children. I know she's somewhat conflicted. She knows what she gave up for her career in order to, you know, raise us and working part-time, because she was fully committed to being a great mother and raising productive, moral, ethical, educated children, as most parents are.
How big was that an issue for you and your husband, your careers?
You know, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this column was because I read this great story in The Atlantic last year by Anne Marie Slaughter about how women can't have it all. And that article forced me to pause and really think about what kind of playing out to its conclusion, what would happen if we had kids. And, you know, that's my hope with this column, too, that it at least gives people a chance to pause and think about, what do I want? Because there is no right answer for everyone. There's only the right answer for you. But I do want it to be a decision, an informed decision.
You did make the point in your column that there is a green aspect to this, but you didn't seem to dwell on that very much, that in a developed world, a child takes up a lot more of a carbon footprint.
Yeah, there's a 2009 Oregon State University study that says the most significant thing you can do to reduce your carbon footprint is to decide not to have children or decide not to have an extra child. Now, if I wanted to have a child, I would I don't care. I wouldn't care about that argument. So that's why I don't linger on it. And I do think that every child believes that their every parent believes their child is going to become grow up, change the world. Like I said, my theoretical hypothetical child would grow up, become a brilliant physicist, and solve global warming. So that's not an issue.
So you asked yourself, am I selfish if I don't have children? And your answer was, I'm selfish for not committing to my hypothetical child's well-being, but I will have a lot more attention and money to shower on real-life nieces, nephews, mentees, and philanthropic causes. Was that a big deal for you, that you will still have outlets?
Yes. I look at the people that have had a major impact in my life, my mentors. Some of them don't have children. Some of the people that have been most helpful in my life don't have children. The selfishness aspect is probably the biggest reaction from people who read this. They think I'm being selfish, which I think is interesting because, you know, what if I had a child and that child grew to be Adam Lanza, the shooter in Newton, or Ian Stawicki, the shooter in Cafe Racer? Would they still think I was selfish now for not having kids? I mean, it is a bit of a roll of the dice. And the other question is, let's talk about gay couples. You know, they're now able to get married. They can choose to have children. Do we consider them selfish for not having kids? And then finally, I look at the impact of, you know, one of the great childless characters who never gets his own voice, who is Jane Eyre's uncle. the person who rescued Jane Eyre wasn't Mr. Rochester. It was her uncle, who was childless, who left her his entire inheritance and liberated her from poverty, right? So, and are we going to call him selfish for not having children? I don't think so.
Sharon Pian Chan is written about why I'm not having kids in the Seattle Times. So here's a few emails. Not having kids. The crux, I broke the news to my grandmother, mother of six, while visiting her in Hong Kong. That's fine, she said in Cantonese, if you want to be lazy. That's what you wrote. Mm-hmm. That's right. That was the crux for you. Did she feel it? Did you understand that notion, being lazy?
Yes, because raising children is really hard work.
So you're being lazy.
I think I'm choosing to put my work ethic towards other things to contribute to the world.
So Ron writes, a couple people write this, human overpopulation is the main driver behind the degradation of our planet. God bless the couple who has enough consideration for their fellow humans to forgo bringing more children into the world. But again, you're saying if you wanted to, that would not be the issue.
No. I mean, if I wanted to have kids, I wouldn't care about overpopulation. And actually, there's a really great story in the Wall Street Journal this weekend about how the fertility rate or people not replacing ourselves in this country is the most important issue facing our economy in the future.
Yeah, I saw that.
And I would say the answer is comprehensive immigration reform.
Well, that's what we're getting for the population growth we're getting right now is basically because we have immigration.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the replacement of American women, births to deaths is just about on par. It would be stasis otherwise.
Yeah, this is a major issue in Japan, major issue in Europe.
Sally Ann writes, I thought I would have one and adopt one, but the economics and environmental impact of kids made me stop at one. I love being a mom and wanted to experience it. I guess stopped at one, having it, not at adopting it. And John says the same thing, I guess, that you mentioned earlier. This question seems kind of backward to me, that with 7 billion humans on the planet, shouldn't we be asking, why did you decide to have kids? Should we be asking ourselves that? Again, not about the ecological aspect, but just overall. I mean, that's the flip side of your question, right?
Steve, the decision to have children is such a personal and gut decision. I think it's hard to, at some point, the intellectual arguments and logical arguments don't matter. And I would never say to a parent, you should not have kids because of overpopulation.
The last thing you write in your column, the ability to bear a child may be what defines me as a female, but I'm still a woman without one. Did you get some people pushing back on that? Is that one of the, I mean?
No, no one took issue with that. But this was an issue I struggled with myself personally.
Yeah.
What does it mean to be a woman? And one of the main things that is about being a woman is about motherhood. And so am I still a woman if I don't decide not to have children? And so that final sentence was really an answer for myself.
Why I'm not having kids, Sharon Pian Chan, a Times editorial columnist. said a lot of discussion around, by the way, around the Times editorial table about this column.
Yes. And most people on our editorial board have children, and I just want to be clear, this column is my own, not the editorial board's position on children.
Well, I appreciate you coming and talking about it.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
This is Weekday.
President Obama will be in Minneapolis today to talk about gun violence. More on that in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Kitsap Propane, with propane tank monitoring services to help keep homes safe, warm, and adequately supplied during the winter months. Home delivery scheduling at kitsappropane.com.
For 20 years, the Family and Medical Leave Act has guaranteed American workers time off for a new baby or family illness. But not everybody.
Many people are cobbling together two or three part-time jobs, none of which have enough hours to make them eligible for family and medical leave.
I'm Renee Montaigne. The Gaps in Family Leave on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.